The U.S. Supreme Court begins its fall term from SDPB. Today is Monday, October 7th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Mike Thompson from the University of Sioux Falls joins us for a preview of some of the court's noteworthy upcoming cases, including the story of a crime that was planned but not committed and whether or not the gun charge should stick. Then, an economic shock with generational implications. Economist Don Fair discusses their research on the decimation of American buffalo herds on bison-reliant communities, plus the drop in interest rates and what it means for South Dakota farmers, and we celebrate World Space Week. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The U.S. Supreme Court is back in session today. I spoke with Mike Thompson about cases before the court that have caught his eye. He's an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. Now, previously, we have discussed a case on the legality of requiring age verification to view adult content websites. We've talked about a case that will decide whether state law can prevent minors from accessing gender-affirming care, and a case about how federal regulations can apply or not apply to so-called ghost guns. In this final part of our conversation with Mike Thompson, we will dive again into gun regulation, as well as cases related to sentencing and vaping. And we'll talk a little bit about a case that didn't make it to the highest court. First, the court will hear an appeal by Salvatore Delgatti. He has associations with the crime family and was convicted in 2018 for hiring members of the Crips gang to kill someone. The plot failed. Delgatti was convicted of attempted murder, among other charges, and it included a gun charge that added 5 years to his prison sentence. As Thompson explains, that case is before the court because of the gun charge.
So, yeah, this one is about, we talk a lot about guns. This is about using a gun or not in a crime of violence, which if you do that, then you're susceptible to sentencing that is consecutive. So I got to serve this term before I can serve the next term. And they just keep.
So it matters.
It matters. It matters. And Mr. Delgatti, he conspired to violate the RICO statute, racketeering and influence corrupt organizations.
Organized crime.
He's a mobster. Because we even mentioned, the court even mentions the crime family in here.
Yes.
So he wants to kill somebody. He's got a gun. He hires members of the Crips gang to do the killing. They can't get it done. The second time they try to kill the target, they get arrested at a traffic stop. So it never happens. So he's charged with 3 counts of conspiracy and 1 count of attempted murder in aid of racketeering. Under, it's 18 United States Code 924C, which is the residual crimes for having a weapon. Mm-hmm. If I have a weapon, use a weapon during a crime of violence, then that's a violation, and it's really going to affect my sentence. So the court says that, and this is, I think, is correct, that if it matters what I say, the conspiracy charges are not crimes of violence. The U.S. Mm-hmm. Supreme Court decided in U.S. v. Davis that the phrase crime of violence is constitutionally vague.
Planning to kill someone is not killing someone.
Right. It's not a crime of violence. Planning to kill somebody is not a crime of violence.
It's a crime.
But it's not a crime of violence. Not a crime of violence. But the thing that has the court's head scratching is the charge of attempted murder in aid of racketeering. Mm-hmm. So he's charged with that. So to that charge was attached, that's a crime of violence. You used a gun during a crime of violence. So therefore, you're going to get sentenced to much longer time mm-hmm. than if you hadn't used the gun. It fascinates me how when the Supreme Court grants a writ of certiorari, they state the issue. And sometimes you can kind of tell where they're leaning by the statement of the issue. So here's the issue. Whether a crime that requires proof of bodily injury or death which would be murder, but can be committed by failing to take action, has an element, the use, attempted use, or threatened use of force. If I can commit something by failing to take action, is that violent? That's what the court's got to figure out.
And it just feels like a Sopranos meets Seinfeld episode to me.
I can see it. I can see it. Yeah.
So if you fail to do something.
First of all, why is a gangster hiring somebody else to do his stuff?
So what are you listening for here?
Well,
because it does have incredibly high stakes for regular people's lives, not just career criminals.
It does. Right. All the career criminals listening out there.
Right.
I think this one is the Supreme Court grants certiorari in a lot of cases where the circuit courts are split or they're disagreeing on how to read it. So it's not a constitutional case. There are no constitutional rights involved. It just depends on your interpretation or the court's interpretation of crime of violence. So I'm looking at how they're going to examine the charge of attempted murder. Because under South Dakota law, to attempt a murder, I have to take action toward the commission.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took action toward the commission, but he didn't, there was no weapon involved, anything like that. So to me, taking action toward the commission of a murder is a crime of violence. And he had a gun, so I don't think that's vague. I think they're lucky to get off on the conspiracy counts for that not being a crime of violence. I don't think the court's going to let him off on this.
Yeah.
Attempted murder, that should be a crime of violence. Should be.
Should we, says
coulda, woulda, shoulda. Yep. Yep.
And we shall
see. The interpretation stops here.
Because the Supreme Court sometimes does things that we don't expect.
Right.
How about vaping?
Vaping.
Food and Drug Administration v. Wages and White Line Investments, LLC. The facts of the case are, sir.
The FDA issued a number of regulations about if you wanted to market fruit-flavored or flavored vaping material, you had to comply with a number of FDA regulations in your application. So the White Lion people, they allegedly did all the FDA told them they were supposed to do to try to get the ability to market the flavored vaping.
Yeah.
So the FDA says, no, we're not approving your marketing plan for this. We're not going to do it. And then White Lion complains and says, we did everything you wanted us to, and we did it like you wanted us to, and now you're denying us.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, your decision is arbitrary and capricious.
You're punishing us because you don't like us. You don't like vaping.
Right. And Fifth Circuit said, well, yeah, the FDA pulled the old switcheroo on them and said, here's what you got to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then said, no, that's not what we said. Well, and even if they do everything as the FDA requested, that doesn't mean they're going to get approved. That just means I've got my application in, and you're free to deny it.
So tell me about this appropriate for the protection of public health part of this, because none of that is, I mean, vaping is bad for you.
Right.
It's bad for public health.
Right. And the FDA is charged to protect public health.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is a private company saying the FDA is overstepped.
Right. The FDA, they're just being mean to us. They told us what they wanted, and then they told us that that didn't matter, and we're denying your application. So, an arbitrary.
Why does the U.S. Supreme Court take this one up?
Because it's a split.
Oh, okay.
Amongst the circuits.
Among circuits. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. Why do you think the circuits are split? What are you seeing in the? What are they split over?
I think they're split over how the FDA has handled the applications. I think.
Okay.
I didn't read any more cases other than this one.
Yeah.
But I would imagine that's what they're split on. But an arbitrary and capricious decision, that's a decision that lacks any basis in the law or the applicable law, whatever law is applicable to you. And I don't see that happening here.
Hewitt v. United States, the First Step Act. This is interesting.
And it's another gun related case that we're back talking about 18 United States Code 924C, which we were talking about in the Delgatti case with the crime of violence. Under 924C, if I commit a number of crimes that fall into that, I can they have stepped up in 924C, they have stepped up sentencing. And they're all mandatory minimums. So the first offense, I get a 5-year mandatory minimum. The second, I get a 25-year mandatory minimum. Most of the time when you have a mandatory minimum, that means the judge can't go below that in sentencing. But there are circumstances sometimes that are allowed to do that. And then I can take those and stack them because they're all consecutive. I got to serve one before I can start serving the other. So it's heavy penalty for violation of that. So in 2018, the First Step Act said you can't do that anymore. You can't stack these 924 violations to get this massive sentence. So Hewitt, he was sentenced before the First Step Act happened in 2018. He was sentenced on all these stacking offenses before then. And then after the act was passed, he was contesting his sentence, and his sentences got vacated, which means a court said, nope, you need to get resentenced. First Step Act says that it will apply to actions that occurred before it was passed, as long as sentence had not been imposed. So Hewitt gets his sentence vacated, which means he's going to go back to the district court, the trial court, and get resentenced. The Fifth Circuit says First Step Act doesn't apply because you received your sentence before it was passed, therefore doesn't apply. The other side of that is, hey, I don't have a sentence right now. It's been vacated.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm entitled to be sentenced under the First Step Act of 2018. So
this is another split
right.
in the circuits.
Yeah. Right.
What are you going to do in this case?
Right.
There were hypotheticals that are now a reality of somebody's life.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, for Hewitt, this is
huge.
But this is a huge impact on his personal life of whether he will be incarcerated for a much, much, much longer time.
Right. And these gun crimes are easy to prove for the most part. You don't have to prove much of an intent necessarily. It's do I got possession of it? And am I committing a certain type of crime? And then it's the sentences are big.
So sometimes it's really a clarification of how something would work.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. And I think what we expect the U.S. Supreme Court to do.
Yeah, I think he's going to win this one. I think they're going to say, "You get to be sentenced."
Why would his sentence be vacated?
It was vacated on other grounds. I don't remember what the grounds were. It wasn't vacated on the First Step Act issue. It was vacated on different grounds. And
right. I mean, hypothetically, why are sentences vacated in general?
He could have been illegally sentenced. He could have had ineffective assistance of counsel.
Sure. Those hypotheticals as we make sure justice was served.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could have been
a lot of things. It's not a statement of his guilt or innocence.
No, it is not. No. He is guilty. It's just a sentencing stage we got to do.
Of course. Yeah. All right. I see.
No, he remains guilty. It's just how much time are we going to give him? Yeah.
Are you looking forward to a new term?
We're
watching a lot in a new term because the consequences are huge. It's an election year.
I
mean, everything is. Do you anticipate it settling down a little bit and us like kind of figuring out how these justices are behaving? Because it doesn't seem like they get along. We saw at the end of last term a heightened, dissent. The language in a dissent was often a desperation. Or a descent of despair, saying like this something horrible happened. Please pay attention. Supreme Court justices were writing language like that in their dissent.
Right.
This is a divided court.
Yeah.
In a divided country.
Right. Yeah. It would be nice if they weren't vitriolic or mean to each other in their writings. That would be nice if they
could just
respect the position and an alternate view of the law. That's what the courts are for, which segues into something. I got one more, but this one is where they denied certiorari. When you talk about fairness, there's a case out of Texas, the Fifth Circuit, and this guy is about to be.
We love you, Texas.
About to be executed. This guy's about to be executed, Mr. Broadnax, James Garfield Broadnax. And there is a case decided by the U.S. Supreme Court back in the 80s called Batson versus Kentucky, which said that the government cannot remove the jurors, prospective jurors, from the jury pool based on race.
Okay.
So Broadnax goes to trial, and the government took all of the African-American jurors off. They used their challenges to the jury to remove them all, which under Batson is prima facie evidence of racial discrimination. The burden would have remained on Broadnax to prove that discrimination was intentional. So Broadnax, he gets convicted, sentenced to death, starts doing some investigating, and he gets a hold of the attorneys. They had a spreadsheet, the prosecutors, and they had made notes and crossed off the African-American jurors. Like, this was prior to trial. So pretty clear evidence of a Batson violation, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, we're not going to hear it, which I think is disappointing, but I'm not them. The Supreme Court dealt with another case that was pretty much like this and actually made a decision that there was a Batson problem. But this is pretty plain, and I don't know if there's some, it's hard to tell if there's some procedural issue with it that, but
they didn't take it up.
Didn't take it up.
So he will be executed.
He will be executed.
Unless pardoned by the governor.
Yes, of Texas.
Mike Thompson is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. The U.S. Supreme Court is back in session today. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The Department of Economics at Augustana University is hosting a series of talks this fall. Don Fair comes to town later this week. Dr. Fair is an applied labor economist and economic historian with the University of Victoria in Canada. One of their specialties is the economic history of North American Indigenous people. Fair joined us via Zoom to share their findings and how they used existing data sets to study history's impacts on the present. Dr. Don Fair, welcome to In the Moment. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
This is such an interesting field of research that you have, first of all, but I've been looking specifically at your paper about the slaughter of the bison and reversal of fortunes on the Great Plains, and thinking about this as an economic problem and an economic shock, which for non-economists might not be the way they're used to approaching this piece of history. Tell me a little bit about the scholarly research gap to study this, if you would begin there.
This is an extraordinarily important moment of history that I think many Americans and others globally are aware of. So in the starting in 1871, there was a rapid slaughter of the North American bison, which used to roam the continent in the tens of millions. And indigenous nations across America, and now what is the U.S. and Canada, relied on the bison for many aspects of their, not just like cultural and spiritual life, but their economic lives. It was an important trade commodity. It could be preserved in times of famine that could supply their communities and the communities that surrounded them. And again, of course, there's a lot of dimensions to the slaughter of the bison, which again went from tens of millions to, by the end of the slaughter in 1889, only about a couple hundred, most of which were in private captivity. A lot of scholars have thought about this from a military perspective or an ecological perspective, of course, both of which are very important. As an economist, I come from a lens of thinking about the loss of an extraordinarily important economic resource for communities and people. And no one until that point had really thought about the impact of the slaughter for the nations that had relied on it for their livelihoods.
Yeah. So what research questions did you come into this particular study with?
So the first question we actually came up with was really related to treaty relationships. Mm-hmm. However, when we were exploring some of these initial empirical relationships, the likelihood of signing a treaty with the United States or Canada by Indigenous nations, we had actually come across data on biological stature of Indigenous people. Someone is a very famous physical anthropologist, sometimes called the father of physical anthropology, Franz Boas. He surveyed with his team over 15,000 Indigenous people across the U.S. and Canada because they thought that a way of life and nationhoods were fading away. So he was commissioned by the Smithsonian Institute and others. And in this data, we had noticed, first of all, other scholars had noted that indigenous people of the Great Plains and other nations that had relied on the North American bison were, in terms of stature, some of the best off people potentially in the world. So just some context, when economic historians don't have information on consumption or income, we often use physical stature as a proxy for well-being, particularly in childhood. So human height, particularly male human height, is very plastic. So it can change a lot if we get good nutrition in childhood and if we have limited access to disease. So if you're taller, it probably means you were fed better and you were healthier overall as a child and had more access to resources. But what we noticed is that this height advantage of the nations of the Great Plains and a few others was completely annihilated by the end of the slaughter of the North American bison. And that made us realize, wait a minute, this was a large shock to the lives of people. Treaties are important, of course, but maybe that came a whole lot after we think about the actual meaningful impact on people's lived experiences.
Yeah. So they have a height advantage and it's just basically erased within a fairly short period of time.
Yep. And around this time period, we also see elevated rates of child mortality. Okay. We also see that there are a greater proportion of female children under the age of 5. And because male children tend to be more biologically fragile than female children, if you see an imbalanced sex ratio toward young girls, you take that as an indicator of nutritional stress of the mother or of the family because of this more fragility of young male children. Yeah. So we see all of these patterns, which align with a lot of the qualitative and historiography of huge famine and economic disruption after the loss of the bison.
And not every, I want to circle back to something you said about how well off these bison reliant communities were. Equal in wealth and stature to what was happening in Europe at the time, help compare globally to what this civilization was like.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, we're talking about taller than the average European at the time, probably as tall, some economists have come after, arguing that they're probably as tall as rural Americans. So I think this pushes back against this narrative that indigenous people were not well off prior to kind of colonization. And many indigenous nations had actually pretty substantively high levels of nutritional well-being. And that's what the patterns in the data would suggest.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about what else you're using to measure the economic shock now. So when you don't have certain information, you look towards some physical or biological markers. What are some of the other ways that you look to measure what happened after the mass annihilation of the bison, particularly for, and you distinguish between indigenous communities that were not as reliant on the bison and the ones that were, and the ones that were suffer more.
Exactly. Right. And again, many nations lost resources, but the particular instance of the slaughter of the bison was so rapid and there was very limited time for adjustment, economic adjustment. After we saw this initial change in height relative to other communities that were not reliant on the bison, we saw elevated rates of mortality and a skew toward female children below the age of 5. Later on in the data, about 1900, 1910, and again, this is where we measure some of the childhood outcomes as well, we also have information on occupations of men, for example. So the first full survey of indigenous nations on reservations in the United States was 1900. And in these data, we can see that those that had formerly relied on the North American bison, many men had no occupation listed at all. And that's true also in 1910, relative to other indigenous nations who had other occupations that were listed. So you could think of this as a major job loss, right? Mm. So if your job was to be the hunter for your family and the provider, but then the thing that you were seeking out or going to hunt was gone, you might have had a difficult time readjusting. And in some, not all, but in some bison-reliant communities, the role of taking on agricultural occupations, which was something the Bureau of Indian Affairs was preventing at the time, there was a stigma for men to be doing that work. Eventually, however, we do see convergence into these agricultural occupations. And I can talk a little bit more about that later, but still from 1945, which is the first year we have data on income for the level of the nation, we do see post 1945, we see systematically lower income for those nations that relied on the North American bison all the way until 2010, which was the last year. It was actually 2017, I think, is the last year we have data. But we do see this like permanently lower shift in income overall. And most economists think that economies generally adjust from large negative shocks. People move, you respecialize. But those options weren't really available to Native Americans over this time period, largely because of the rules imposed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Can you compare it to any other kind of economic shock, the scale of this?
I mean, the scale of this is kind of unprecedented, I think, for many communities, to think that everybody in the town loses their job, basically. So I kind of joke, I'm Canadian and I'm originally from a province called Alberta. It's kind of the Texas of Canada. And I kind of just think, imagine if you took all the oil out of Alberta or all the oil out of Texas, right? I mean, that's a pretty large negative shock to many people's livelihoods.
Yeah.
And again, in many circumstances, economists expect people to move, right? If Alberta is no longer a place where people can find work, you go somewhere else and find work, say in British Columbia or Montana or somewhere else. But in this case, you're essentially, Native Americans didn't have the rights of citizens until 1924, and that included the right to free mobility. And people often didn't want to leave the reservation because of discrimination and other forces. So people had limited mobility. And in addition, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, during a time in which the United States was rapidly industrializing, they were encouraging Indigenous people to go into farming occupations, which was not really the way the rest of the American economy was heading.
Hmm.
Again, it's hard to find a precise parallel, but
right.
Think of it as a very large shock to a town, like right. Losing the only firm in the town.
Right, and you can't leave, and you really can't respecialize. They want them to be what exactly? Large-scale industrial farmers. The policies,
policies
are in the way of that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. I mean, a lot of this farming is more thought to be like kind of smaller scale farming.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and then this idea of access to credit, I also found very interesting. Another way to recover more quickly is to find ways to rebuild or to build. And that is also denied to this day.
Yep. No, it's true. Access to credit is still a major issue for many Indigenous nations and individual people. And at the time, too, there was limited access to credit, partially due to access to banks. So particularly by the 1920s, Indigenous people could take out loans or mortgages. But of course, if you're in an area where there is no financial institution, that's far harder. But we do find that communities that had more access to banking institutions earlier don't suffer to the same degree as the nations that didn't. So if you didn't have access to a bank, the only real alternative was funds from, again, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which was promoting a very specific type of economic activity that was largely on the decline. Again, I know that there are still very many large agricultural producers in the United States. It's an important industry. But again, they weren't necessarily investing in the sort of capital equipment that was necessary to like engage in large-scale farming.
Yeah. What kind of research did you do to eliminate other factors, to sort of narrow things down and say, oh, this is what we're looking at and not these? Because when we started out our conversation, I think about just how many different factors are at play, and people listening will say, but wasn't it also this, or wasn't it also that, or you haven't talked about this. You do a lot of research to narrow the scope of your work. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would.
Of course, history is always complex, but we've made the best effort we can to draw in data from various sources and data sets to try to rule out other explanations. So for example, a lot of really great economists have written on the impact of the Dust Bowl, right? Mm-hmm. But we have data to know where the Dust Bowl was most severe, right? So we know the extent of erosion, whether it was like minimal, medium, very extreme erosion. We also have data, say, on soil quality. We know that reservations didn't always have the best soil quality. So we can merge that information in with the other data sets we have and use statistical methods to essentially say, holding those factors constant, what is the impact of the loss of the bison? Mm. Another important factor is during the slaughter of the bison, a lot of people are concerned while people are also moving on reservations. Well, the reservation period did start in the 1850s, so that's partially, the timing doesn't quite work, but we still can use data on the time in which your community received a reservation, or the time the first railway entered your territory, or if it entered at all.
Mm-hmm.
So we can again use data on timing and say, okay, conditional or accounting for the fact that these things were also going on, there seems to be still a large statistical difference based simply on historical bison reliance and still relying on the bison when the rapid slaughter began.
What does this tell us about the future? Because this is not a ancient history lesson. These are communities and people who are living and thriving today, but also facing some serious economic challenges in many cases. Can we
it's
look
really
forward
important.
At all? Yeah.
Oh, of course. Yes. No, I mean, these things are not written in stone. I mean, history is not destiny. So first of all, there are many communities that have taken substantive actions to get access to credit, to invest in their communities, to make change. There is a treaty, I think it was 14 nations, maybe more have been added, the Buffalo Treaty, where both nations in Canada and the United States have mutually agreed to reintroduce the bison into their territory. Well, this itself may be an economic benefit. It isn't potentially the most important one. So thinking about how to resolve poverty traps in general, because we believe this is actually what the loss of the bison created and then generations of other restrictions. So we think it may be necessary. It's just large-scale investment to move people out of poverty traps. So we think that's one of the first things to take away, is that we have an environment where things have clustered together to make growth hard. So getting to that next stage might take additional effort. The other important, I think, thing to think about is how to handle large shocks in the future, right? And the connection between our environment and our own livelihoods. So while this is not like an ecological economics paper or anything of that dimension, we do rely on our environment immensely for many things. And if there is rapid, substantive change that affects our access to resources, and if there is no way for us to re-specialize, then we are going to have problems in the long run in general.
Hmm. Help us understand what a poverty trap is.
Mm-hmm. A poverty trap is something that happens when, so economists tend to think about the economy as always converging to a steady state equilibrium. So, mm-hmm. you know, an employment rate of 5% or whatever, we think that this is stable over time, and shocks will move us away from that kind of average. But depending on the structure of the economy, sometimes a shock can move you from one stable equilibrium to a different stable equilibrium, potentially worse. So sometimes people have talked about this as like virtuous cycles or vicious circles. So it's the idea that I think maybe the easiest way to think about it is nutrition. If you can't afford to have good nutrition, then going to work in agricultural fields is really hard. So you're not as productive. So you can't afford food. So you're hungry. So you go back to the field and you still can't work as hard. So you can't earn what you need to feed yourself well. So you're stuck in this cycle, essentially, of poverty. So it's this idea that poverty can beget poverty. If you don't have money or collateral, it's hard to actually access capital, right? If you don't get capital, it's hard to actually build collateral. So it's just this is kind of reinforcing mechanism is what traps people in regions in particular into poverty sometimes.
For students of economics, where would you invite them to look for areas of research that have been unexplored?
Oh, that's a tough question. All of us have such diverse experiences as people, as individuals, and sometimes just reflecting on the things that other people say that you don't think are obvious can help you lead to a good research question. So a lot of people might be presumptions because of their own experiences, the things they've seen in their lives. And if that doesn't necessarily ring correct to you, maybe reflect on why, and maybe there's an interesting research question in that.
I love that answer. Economist Don Fair visits Augustana University October 17th and 18th. We'll put more information online, sdpb.org. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A new U.S. jobs report on Friday showed strong job growth and a continued drop in the unemployment rate. In other good news, average wages are going up faster than prices. Patience might be the order of the day for the Federal Reserve, which is to say the Fed may not be in a rush to drastically cut interest rates. Let's explore what the most recent rate cut and uncertainty about future cuts means for South Dakota farmers. Dan English is head of FBN Finance. Dan English, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to see you.
Likewise. Yeah. Likewise.
All right. Let's start with the big news of a small interest rate cut. Help us understand how farmers and producers watch for these cuts, these rate cuts from the Fed, and their decision-making process here in the fall.
Yeah. So for the last, you know, really since kind of 2008, this has not been a big issue for farmers, kind of up until 18 months or so ago, or 2 years ago. And it was, you know, rates were relatively low. Farmers have a ton of debt on their balance sheet, not just financing their operations, but of course, buying land and equipment, you know, which are both kind of more expensive and have been more expensive than ever. And so it's really a very important thing, but one that could kind of sit on the back burner. The Fed was not making big policy moves or anything like that. And then obviously kind of after COVID, when inflation spiked, it went from being something that was very expensive for farmers to something that was incredibly expensive for farmers and consumers alike. And so it's something that we saw our farmers become much more sensitive to. You know, the amount of farmers that were purchasing land decreased, certainly on financing, the amount that we're looking to refinance certainly decreased. What's typical is they can tap into their land value for equity in hard times. And so as we saw commodity prices coming down, it's kind of like some farmers were stuck in a little bit of a golden handcuff situation where they couldn't tap into their equity because they would lose a great rate, but they probably needed to start thinking about doing that. And so this doesn't get us all the way there, this cut, but it does start to free it up. It also makes it easier if they need an operating line to get that at a cheaper rate than it would have been a year ago. And what the Fed has said is that they'll probably cut another 1.5 points over the course of kind of the next year, 2 years. And so that'll actually be pretty meaningful for savings for farmers. Some of that's already priced into what we've seen on the real estate side, but for operating loan notes, which are very short-term based, a lot of savings are yet to come, hopefully, on that front.
All right. Help people understand an operating line note and give me an example of when someone would use that, how common they are, and how to leverage it in the most financially beneficial way for the farmer.
So most, you know, farmers have to plant in the spring, and they don't get to harvest and sell till the fall. And so the operating loan note is designed to provide a bridge from that time to help them buy seed, fertilizer, chemical from places like FBN to use in the beginning of the year and kind of throughout the season. And then they also have typically land payments, equipment payments, stuff like that they need to make over the course of the year. And so it's a pretty common practice for farmers to use it. There's probably, depending on kind of how you slice the data, $40 to $60 billion of farm operating debt that's outstanding kind of at any one time. And so, you know, if that goes down by 2 percentage points, that's $800 million in the pocketbooks of farmers, which is terrific, terrific. But we're only a quarter of the way there. But still, $200 million this year for farmers is a great, great benefit if that comes through.
What else is intersecting with this when it comes to election politics, commodity prices, natural disasters, strikes? How many different factors are weighing on the industry now?
A lot. you know, FBN's been around 10 years, which kind of in the whole arc of agriculture is not that long, but we have seen a couple cycles now go through. And in periods like this, when commodity prices are relatively low, it puts a lot of pressures on farms. Fortunately, we had a couple good years. And so farmers' balance sheets were coming in relatively strong into the last year. But we saw a lot of farmers who were hoping for better grain prices this last year, held on to the summer of their grain and ended up riding some of those prices down, which you never want to see. So that puts them in kind of a tight position going into the year. Hopefully a little bit of relief on the interest rate side. But for farmers who still have very low rates from 2020 and 2021, they're going to be facing some very tough decisions as to whether or not they can tap into their equity. And then when you think about politics, you know, obviously everyone's going to have their own opinions as to the right thing, and there's a lot of other issues.
Yeah.
But tariffs and stuff certainly will have a meaningful effect on the ability of our producers to sell their products abroad. Last time when some of those tariffs were put in place, there was offsetting payments that were made to farmers to help them deal with that. And so I think it remains to be seen what the net impact is, but it is something that I know a lot of our farmers are watching with trepidation.
Right. All right. Will there be more rate cuts and any predictions about the timing of them and the relevance of that timing?
Yeah. What the Fed has published and said is they expect rates to come down another 1.5%
between now and basically the end of 2025. So that's still a very, very meaningful reduction. Mm-hmm. Now, they still have a lot of language around wanting to be nimble and paying attention to a lot of data and balancing the risks between rate cuts and further inflation. So I think if we see an inflation report come out at some point in the next year and a half that is a little bit higher than they expect, they might slow down the pace of that. If there's continued softening in the labor market, which is really what the Fed has said, they kind of weigh those two risks equally right now. But if it tilts towards one or the other, then they'll make a corresponding change. So if there's some softening in the labor market, then we would expect faster rate cuts than we might have otherwise.
Sure. What else is a topic of discussion right now that you want to make sure to get in today?
Well, I would say a lot of our farmers have been paying attention to prices, thinking about how they market their grain. In the past couple of years, with relatively high prices, you know, everyone was selling at good prices, and it kind of felt like, hey, maybe I don't need to pay as much attention to this or think as much about my strategy for how I hedge and the role that crop insurance plays in that. We expect that to be different this coming year because farmers are really going to need to get kind of every single cent that they can. Tied to that, you know, continuing growth in sustainability programs that use deforestation, premium for soybeans that come from non-deforested ground has been a way for farmers to get some extra money in the short term. With all of these things, there's a lot of bigger factors that come into play, but it can be a way for farmers to get a premium in the short term. So we expect some folks will take advantage of that. And then I would say, you know, you mentioned it, but the election, I think a lot of people are watching that and what the effect on regulation will be, what the effect on tariffs, things like taxes, the estate tax, you know, is important for a lot of our farmers and they think about it. And so there's a ton of factors up in the air in what's already an uncertain industry, unfortunately.
Right. And just how you feel about going through an election year, the uncertainty that you might feel about your potential candidate and what will happen to you if the candidate that you don't want win. So everybody take a deep breath. Go back to the fundamentals and the basics of the things that you already know how to do. Get the information that works for you and make those decisions.
And, you know, the way we think about it here kind of at FBN is there's what farmers like to do is they like to, you know, be farmers. Right. They don't like to have to worry about finances or politics or the other things. That's the stuff that unfortunately intrudes in them doing their day-to-day job of, you know, growing food and running a profitable company. And so hopefully there'll be a little bit of a respite at some point on that. But right now it's a very challenging time.
Yeah. All right, Dan, thank you so much for the update. We really appreciate it, as always.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Lori.
That's Dan English, General Manager of FBN Finance.
We've come to witness, traveled for days, high anticipation for a 2-minute gaze.
To close today's show, we honor World Space Week. It's an international celebration of science and space and the general wonders of the night sky. Hank Fradel is a member of the Black Hills Astronomical Society. You heard a bit of his song Witness from his band Dust Up. Fradel joined the show in April to preview a rare and extraordinary planetary event, a total solar eclipse. He joined us via Zoom from Texas, which had the best view of the phenomenon. Here he explains the science of an eclipse.
You know, there's a couple different kinds of solar eclipses. There's the annular ones, which it doesn't get dark. It doesn't cover up the sun. And that's because the moon is further away from the Earth. You get this rim or the ring of fire showing on the sun. But this time the moon is going to be close enough to the Earth that it's going to block it out. And so that's pretty exciting. There's some cool things that happen for total eclipses that don't ever happen at any other time. So that's what we're here to see.
So we are, lay people are endlessly fascinated with this, as I'm sure human beings have been throughout history. But scientists learn and have learned from eclipses about the Earth, about the moon, about the sun. Help me understand the science that goes into, you know, how scientists prepare for this event and if there are researchers who are measuring things to try to figure out something new.
Well, you know, the big thing is that during a total eclipse, there are two parts of the sun that we're paying attention to. One is the planisphere, and that is the actual glow that's coming off the sun. And that's what you wear the solar glasses for. Whenever there's that planisphere is showing, you want to make sure you have your glasses on. When the you go into totality, there's this corona around the sun, which is really the outer atmosphere of the sun, and that is not as bright. And during that time, you don't need to wear your solar glasses, but you need to be careful at those transition points, because some cool things happen during those transitions, such as the diamond ring, where the last little bit of sunlight shines through, as well as having the coronas around it, and it makes it look like a little diamond ring. There's also these beads that show up right around the edge where the moon and the sun are hitting, and it's what that really is doing is the very last of the sunlight is shining through the mountains and valleys of the moon, and it ends up with these little string of pearls that show up on the edge, and it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. I'm hoping to see it anyway. And the other thing that's cool about the corona is that we never get to see it because the planisphere just blocks it out. And so when we're able to totally see what that corona is about, and it's going to be cool this year because we've got this solar maximum going on right now where there's lots of solar activity. I'm hoping that we're going to be able to see, once we get into totality, pull up my binoculars and be able to see some of that corona. It's going to be fun.
Why are we so endlessly fascinated with this moment we can't seem to get enough of, an eclipse, and really how the planet and the universe works? There's a lot of other things we could be thinking about in the world right now, Hank, but it's a time to turn to the skies.
That's right, it is. You know, and it's this thing, these total solar eclipses are kind of rare. We had one fairly recently in 2017, but the next one that's going to be showing up here in the United States is only going to be showing up like in Montana and North Dakota, and that's in 2044. And that's only about a 2-minute duration. The next one after that is going to be the following year, which is 2045, and I'm only going to be 96 at that time. And that's going to go all the way from California all the way across that lower Midwest part of the country and come out down in Florida and Georgia. And so that's going to be a big one.
Wow.
And I'm already making my reservations.
Hank Fradel had a great view of the April 2024 total solar eclipse. Welcome to World Space Week. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. We leave you with more of the song Witness, Hank Fradel and Jeff Sweet. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.
As it came, a sudden beam's glow lights up the earth, returning status quo. But somehow it's different. Somehow